gesture of reproachful helplessness. "Now you see, Dr. Stadler, how unfortunate it is if you allow yourself to be disturbed by political matters, which you have always considered unworthy of your attention and knowledge. You see, it is not Mr. Mouch's function to ask permissions." The figure now slouching against the sky on the speaker's platform, coiling itself about the microphone, talking in the bored, contemptuous tone of an off-color story, was Dr. Simon Pritchett. He was declaring that the new invention was an instrument of social welfare, which guaranteed general prosperity, and that anyone who doubted this self-evident fact was an enemy of society, to be treated accordingly. This invention, the product of Dr. Robert Stadler, the preeminent lover of freedom. Dr. Ferris opened a briefcase, produced some pages of neatly typed copy, and turned to Dr. Stadler. "You are to be the climax of the broadcast," he said. "You will speak last, at the end of the hour." He extended the pages. "Here's the speech you'll make." His eyes said the rest. They said that his choice of words had not been accidental. Dr. Stadler took the pages but held them between the tips of two straight fingers, as one might hold a scrap of waste paper about to be tossed aside. "I haven't asked you to appoint yourself as my ghostwriter," he said. The sarcasm of the voice gave Ferris his clue. This was not a moment for sarcasm. "I couldn't have allowed your invaluable time to be taken up by the writing of radio speeches," said Dr. Ferris. "I felt certain that you would appreciate it." He said it in a tone of spurious politeness intended to be recognized as spurious, the tone of tossing to a beggar the alms of face-saving. Dr. Stadler's answer disturbed him. Dr. Stadler did not choose to answer or to glance down at the manuscript. "Lack of faith," a beefy speaker was snarling on the platform in the tone of a street brawl. "Lack of faith is the only thing we gotta fear. If we have faith in the plans of our leaders, why, the plans will work, and we'll all have prosperity and ease and plenty. It's the fellows who go around doubting and destroying our morale. It's they who are keeping us in shortages and misery. But we're not going to let them do it much longer. We're here to protect the people. And if any of those doubting smarties come around, believe you me, we'll take care of them." "It would be unfortunate," said Dr. Ferris in a soft voice, "to arouse popular resentment against the State Science Institute at an explosive time like the present. There's a great deal of dissatisfaction and unrest in the country, and if people should misunderstand the nature of the new invention, they're liable to vent their rage on all scientists. Scientists have never been popular with the masses." "Peace," a tall, willowy woman was sighing into the microphone. "This invention is a great new instrument of peace. It will protect us from the aggressive designs of selfish enemies. It will allow us to breathe freely and to learn to love our fellow men." She had a bony face with a mouth embittered at cocktail parties and wore a flowing pale blue gown, suggesting the concert garment of a harpist. "It may well be considered as that miracle which was thought impossible in history, the dream of the ages, the final synthesis of science and love." Dr. Stadler looked at the faces in the grandstands. They were sitting quietly now. They were listening, but their eyes had an ebbing look of twilight, a look of fear in the process of being accepted as permanent, the look of raw wounds being dimmed by the veil of infection. They knew, as he knew it, that they were the targets of the shapeless funnels protruding from the mushroom building's dome, and he wondered in what manner they were now extinguishing their minds and escaping that knowledge. He knew that the words they were eager to absorb and believe were the chains slipping in to hold them, like the goats, securely within the range of those funnels. They were eager to believe. He saw the tightening lines of their lips. He saw the occasional glances of suspicion they threw at their neighbors, as if the horror that threatened them was not the sound ray, but the men who would make them acknowledge it as horror. Their eyes were veiling over, but the remnant look of a wound was a cry for help.
"Why do you think they think?"
said Dr. Ferris softly. "Reason is the scientist's only weapon, and reason has no power over men, has it? At a time like ours, with the country falling apart, with the mob driven by blind desperation to the edge of open riots and violence, order must be maintained by any means available. What can we do when we have to deal with people?" Dr. Stadler did not answer. A fat, jellied woman with an inadequate brassiere under a dark, perspiration-stained dress was saying into the microphone, Dr. Stadler could not believe it at first, that the new invention was to be greeted with particular gratitude by the mothers of the country. Dr. Stadler turned away. Watching him, Ferris could see nothing but the noble line of the high forehead and the deep cut of bitterness at the corner of the mouth. Suddenly, without context or warning, Robert Stadler whirled to face him. It was like a spurt of blood from a sudden crack in a wound that had almost closed. Stadler's face was open, open in pain, in horror, in sincerity, as if, for that moment, both he and Ferris were human beings, while he moaned with incredulous despair, "In a civilized century, Ferris, in a civilized century." Dr. Ferris took his time to produce and prolong a soft chuckle. "I don't know what you're talking about," he answered in the tone of a quotation. Dr. Stadler lowered his eyes. When Ferris spoke again, his voice had the faintest edge of a tone which Stadler could not define, except that it did not belong in any civilized discussion. "It would be unfortunate if anything were to happen to jeopardize the State Science Institute. It would be most unfortunate if the Institute were to be closed, or if any one of us were to be forced to leave it. Where would we go? Scientists are an inordinate luxury these days, and there aren't many people or establishments left who are able to afford necessities, let alone luxuries. There are no doors left open to us. We wouldn't be welcome in the research department of an industrial concern such as, let us say, Reardon Steel. Besides, if we should happen to make enemies, the same enemies would be feared by any person tempted to employ our talents. A man like Reardon would have fought for us. Would a man like Orrin Boyle? But this is purely theoretical speculation because, as a matter of practical fact, all private establishments of scientific research have been closed by law. By Directive 10-289, issued, as you might not realize, by Mr. Wesley Mouch. Are you thinking, perhaps, of universities? They are in the same position. They can't afford to make enemies. Who would speak up for us? I believe that some such man as Hugh Axton would have come to our defense. But to think of that is to be guilty of an anachronism. He belonged to a different age. The conditions set up in our social and economic reality have long since made his continued existence impossible. And I don't think that Dr. Simon Pritchett, or the generation reared under his guidance, would be able or willing to defend us. I have never believed in the efficacy of idealists, have you? And this is no age for impractical idealism. If anyone wished to oppose a government policy, how would he make himself heard? Through these gentlemen of the press, Dr. Stadler? Through this microphone? Is there an independent newspaper left in the country? An uncontrolled radio station? A private piece of property, for that matter? Or a personal opinion? The tone of the voice was obvious now. It was the tone of a thug. A personal opinion is the one luxury that nobody can afford today. Dr. Stadler's lips moved stiffly as the muscles of the goats. You are speaking to Robert Stadler. I have not forgotten that. It is precisely because I have not forgotten it that I am speaking. Robert Stadler is an illustrious name, which I would hate to see destroyed. But what is an illustrious name nowadays? In whose eyes? His arm swept over the grandstands. In the eyes of people such as you see around you? If they will believe, when so told, that an instrument of death is a tool of prosperity, would they not believe it if they were told that Robert Stadler is a traitor and an enemy of the state? Would you then rely on the fact that this is not true? Are you thinking of truth, Dr. Stadler? Questions of truth do not enter into social issues. Principles have no influence on public affairs. Reason has no power over human beings. Logic is impotent. Morality is superfluous. Do not answer me now, Dr. Stadler. You will answer me over the microphone. You're the next speaker. Looking off at the dark strip of the farm in the distance, Dr. Stadler knew that what he felt was terror, but he would not permit himself to know its nature. He, who had been able to study the particles and subparticles of cosmic space, would not permit himself to examine his feelings and to know that it was made of three parts. One part was terror of a vision that seemed to stand before his eyes, the vision of the inscription cut in his honor over the door of the Institute, to the fearless mind, to the inviolate truth. Another part was a plain, brute, animal fear of physical destruction, a humiliating fear which, in the civilized world of his youth, he had not expected ever to experience. And the third was the terror of the knowledge that by betraying the first, one delivers oneself into the realm of the second. He walked toward the speaker's scaffold, his steps firm and slow, his head lifted, the manuscript of the speech held crumpled in his fingers. It looked like a walk to mount either a pedestal or a guillotine. As the whole of a man's life flashes before him in his dying moment, so he walked to the sound of the announcer's voice reading to the country the list of Robert Stadler's achievements and career. A faint convulsion ran over Robert Stadler's face at the words, "Former head of the Department of Physics of the Patrick Henry University." He knew distantly, not as if the knowledge were within him, but as if it were within some person he was leaving behind, that the crowd was about to witness an act of destruction more terrible than the destruction of the farm. He had mounted the first three steps of the scaffold when a young newsman tore forward, ran to him, and, from below, seized the railing to stop him. "Dr. Stadler," he cried in a desperate whisper, "tell them the truth. Tell them that you had nothing to do with it. Tell them what sort of infernal machine it is and for what purpose it's intended to be used. Tell the country what sort of people are trying to rule it. Nobody can doubt your word. Tell them the truth. Save us. You're the only one who can." Dr. Stadler looked down at him. He was young. His movements and voice had that swift, sharp clarity which belongs to competence. Among his aged, corrupt, favor-ridden, and pull-created colleagues, he had managed to achieve the rank of elite of the political press by means and in the role of a last, irresistible spark of ability. His eyes had the look of an eager, unfrightened intelligence. They were the kind of eyes Dr. Stadler had seen looking up at him from the benches of classrooms. He noticed that this boy's eyes were hazel. They had a tinge of green. Dr. Stadler turned his head and saw that Ferris had come rushing to his side, like a servant or a jailer. "I do not expect to be insulted by disloyal young punks with treasonable motives," said Dr. Stadler loudly. Dr. Ferris whirled upon the young man and snapped, his face out of control, distorted by rage at the unexpected and unplanned, "Give me your press card and your work permit." "I am proud," Dr. Robert Stadler read into the microphone and into the attentive silence of a nation, "that my years of work in the service of science have brought me the honor of placing into the hands of our great leader, Mr. Thompson, a new instrument with an incalculable potential for a civilizing and liberating influence upon the mind of man." The sky had the stagnant breath of a furnace, and the streets of New York were like pipes running, not with air and light, but with melted dust. Dagny stood on a street corner, where the airport bus had left her, looking at the city in passive astonishment. The buildings seemed worn by weeks of summer heat, but the people seemed worn by centuries of anguish. She stood watching them, disarmed by an enormous sense of unreality. That sense of unreality had been her only feeling since the early hours of the morning, since the moment when, at the end of an empty highway, she had walked into an unknown town and stopped the first passer-by to ask where she was. "Watsonville," he answered.
"What state, please?" she asked.
The man glanced at her, said, "Nebraska," and walked hastily away. She smiled mirthlessly, knowing that he wondered where she had come from, and that no explanation he could imagine would be as fantastic as the truth. Yet it was Watsonville that seemed fantastic to her as she walked through its streets to the railroad station. She had lost the habit of observing despair as the normal and dominant aspect of human existence, so normal as to become unnoticed, and the sight of it struck her in all of its senseless futility. She was seeing the brand of pain and fear on the faces of people, and the look of evasion that refuses to know it. They seemed to be going through the motions of some enormous pretense, acting out a ritual to ward off reality, letting the earth remain unseen and their lives unlived, in dread of something namelessly forbidden. Yet the forbidden was the simple act of looking at the nature of their pain and questioning their duty to bear it. She was seeing it so clearly that she kept wanting to approach strangers, to shake them, to laugh in their faces, and to cry, "Snap out of it!" There was no reason for people to be as unhappy as that, she thought. No reason whatever. And then she remembered that reason was the one power they had banished from their existence. She boarded a Taggart train for the nearest airfield. She did not identify herself to anyone. It seemed irrelevant. She sat at the window of a coach, like a stranger who has to learn the incomprehensible language of those around her. She picked up a discarded newspaper. She managed with effort to understand what was written, but not why it should ever have been written. It all seemed so childishly senseless. She stared in astonishment at a paragraph in a syndicated column from New York, which stated over-emphatically that Mr. James Taggart wished it to be known that his sister had died in an airplane crash, any unpatriotic rumors to the contrary notwithstanding. Slowly, she remembered Directive 10-289 and realized that Jim was embarrassed by the public suspicion that she had vanished as a deserter. The wording of the paragraph suggested that her disappearance had been a prominent public issue, not yet dropped. There were other suggestions of it. A mention of Miss Taggart's tragic death in a story about the growing number of plane crashes, and on the back page an ad offering a $100,000 reward to the person who would find the wreckage of her plane, signed by Henry Reardon. The last gave her a stab of urgency. The rest seemed meaningless. Then, slowly, she realized that her return was a public event which would be taken as big news. She felt a lethargic weariness at the prospect of a dramatic homecoming, of facing Jim and the press, of witnessing the excitement. She wished they would get it over with in her absence. At the airfield, she saw a small-town reporter interviewing some departing officials. She waited till he had finished, then she approached him, extended her credentials, and said quietly, to the gaping stare of his eyes, "I'm Dagny Taggart. Would you make it known, please, that I'm alive and that I'll be in New York this afternoon?" The plane was about to take off, and she escaped the necessity of answering questions. She watched the prairies, the rivers, the towns slipping past at an untouchable distance below, and she noted that the sense of detachment one feels when looking at the earth from a plane was the same sense she felt when looking at people. Only her distance from people seemed longer. The passengers were listening to some radio broadcast, which appeared to be important, judging by their earnest attentiveness. She caught brief snatches of fraudulent voices talking about some sort of new invention that was to bring some undefined benefits to some undefined public's welfare. The words were obviously chosen to convey no specific meaning whatever. She wondered how one could pretend that one was hearing a speech. Yet that was what the passengers were doing. They were going through the performance of a child who, not yet able to read, holds a book open and spells out anything he wishes to spell, pretending that it is contained in the incomprehensible black lines. But the child, she thought, knows that he is playing a game. These people pretend to themselves that they are not pretending. They know no other state of existence. The sense of unreality remained as her only feeling when she landed, when she escaped a crowd of reporters without being seen, by avoiding the taxi stands and leaping into the airport bus, when she rode on the bus, then stood on a street corner looking at New York. She felt as if she were seeing an abandoned city. She felt no sense of homecoming when she entered her apartment. The place seemed to be a convenient machine that she could use for some purpose of no significance whatever. But she felt a quickened touch of energy, like the first break in a fog, a touch of meaning, when she picked up the telephone receiver and called Reardon's office in Pennsylvania. "Oh, Miss Taggart, Miss Taggart," said, in a joyous moan, the voice of the severe, unemotional Miss Ives. "Hello, Miss Ives. I haven't startled you, have I? You knew that I was alive."
"Oh, yes. I heard it on the radio this morning."
"Is Mr. Reardon in his office?"
"No, Miss Taggart. He's in the Rocky Mountains, searching for... That is..."
"Yes, I know. Do you know where we can reach him?"
"I expect to hear from him at any moment. He's stopping in Los Gatos, Colorado, right now. I phoned him the moment I heard the news, but he was out, and I left a message for him to call me. You see, he's out flying most of the day, but he'll call me when he comes back to the hotel."
"What hotel is it?"
"The El Dorado Hotel in Los Gatos."
"Thank you, Miss Ives." She was about to hang up.
"Oh, Miss Taggart."
"Yes?"
"What was it that happened to you? Where were you?"
I'll tell you when I see you. I'm in New York now. When Mr. Reardon calls, tell him, please, that I'll be in my office."
"Yes, Miss Taggart."
She hung up, but her hand remained on the receiver, clinging to her first contact with a matter that had importance. She looked at her apartment and at the city in the window, feeling reluctant to sink again into the dead fog of the meaningless. She raised the receiver and called Los Gatos.
"El Dorado Hotel," said a woman's drowsily resentful voice.
"Would you take a message for Mr. Henry Reardon? Ask him when he comes in to..."
"Just a minute, please," drawled the voice, in the impatient tone that resents any effort as an imposition.
She heard the clicking of switches, some buzzing, some breaks of silence, and then a man's clear, firm voice answering, "Hello?" It was Hank Reardon. She stared at the receiver as at the muzzle of a gun, feeling trapped, unable to breathe. "Hello?" he repeated.
"Hank, is that you?"
She heard a low sound, more a sigh than a gasp, and then the long, empty crackling of the wire.
"Hank?"
There was no answer.
"Hank!"
she screamed in terror. She thought she heard the effort of a breath. Then she heard a whisper, which was not a question, but a statement saying everything.
"Dagny. Hank, I'm sorry. Oh, darling, I'm sorry. Didn't you know?"
"Where are you, Dagny?"
"Are you all right?"
"Of course."
"Didn't you know that I was back and alive?"
"No. I didn't know it."
"Oh, God, I'm sorry I called.
What are you talking about? Dagny, where are you?"
"In New York. Didn't you hear about it on the radio?"
"No. I've just come in."
"Didn't they give you a message to call Miss Ives?"
"No."
"Are you all right?"
"Now?" She heard his soft, low chuckle. She was hearing the sound of unreleased laughter, the sound of youth, growing in his voice with every word. "When did you come back?"
"This morning."
"Dagny, where were you?" She did not answer at once.
"My plane crashed," she said, "in the Rockies. I was picked up by some people who helped me, but I could not send word to anyone."
The laughter went out of his voice. "As bad as that?"
"Oh, the crash?
No, it wasn't bad.
I wasn't hurt, not seriously.
Then why couldn't you send word?
There were no means of communication.
Why did it take you so long to get back?
I can't answer that now.
Dagny, were you in danger? The half-smiling, half-bitter tone of her voice was almost regret, as she answered,
No.
Were you held prisoner?
No, not really.
Then you could have returned sooner, but didn't.
That's true. But that's all I can tell you.
Where were you, Dagny?
Do you mind if we don't talk about it now? Let's wait until I see you.
Of course. I won't ask any questions. Just tell me. Are you safe now?
Safe? Yes.
I mean, have you suffered any permanent injuries or consequences? She answered with the same sound of a cheerless smile.
Injuries? No, Hank. I don't know as to the permanent consequences.
Will you still be in New York tonight?
Why, yes. I'm back for good.
Are you?
Why do you ask that?
I don't know. I guess I'm too used to what it's like when I can't find you.
I'm back.
Yes. I'll see you in a few hours. His voice broke off, as if the sentence were too enormous to believe.
In a few hours, he repeated firmly. I'll be here.
Dagny.
Yes.
He chuckled softly.
No, nothing.
Just wanted to hear your voice a while longer. Forgive me. I mean, not now. I mean, I don't want to say anything now.
Hank, I...
When I see you, my darling. So long. She stood looking at the silent receiver. For the first time since her return, she felt pain. A violent pain, but it made her alive, because it was worth feeling. She telephoned her secretary at Taggart Transcontinental to say briefly that she would be in the office in half an hour. The statue of Nathaniel Taggart was real when she stood facing it in the concourse of the terminal. It seemed to her that they were alone in a vast, echoing temple with fog coils of formless ghosts weaving and vanishing around them. She stood still, looking up at the statue as for a brief moment of dedication.
I'm back.
Were the only words she had to offer. Dagny Taggart was still the inscription on the frosted glass panel of the door to her office. The look on the faces of her staff as she entered the anteroom was the look of drowning persons at the sight of a lifeline. She saw Eddie Willers standing at his desk in his glass enclosure with some man before him. Eddie made a move in her direction but stopped. He looked imprisoned. She let her glance greet every face in turn, smiling at them gently as at doomed children, then walked toward Eddie's desk. Eddie was watching her approach as if he were seeing nothing else in the world, but his rigid posture seemed designed to pretend that he was listening to the man before him. Motive, power? The man was saying in a voice that had a brusque, staccato snap and a slurred nasal drawl together. There's no problem about motive, power. You just take...
Hello,
said Eddie softly, with a muted smile, as to a distant vision. The man turned to glance at her. He had a yellow complexion, curly hair, a hard face made of soft muscles, and the revolting handsomeness belonging to the aesthetic standards of barroom corners. His blurred brown eyes had the empty flatness of glass.
Miss Taggart, said Eddie, in a resonant tone of severity, the tone of slapping the man into the manners of a drawing room he had never entered. May I present Mr. Miggs?
How to do, said the man without interest, then turned to Eddie and proceeded, as if she were not present. You just take the Comet off the schedule for tomorrow and Tuesday, and shoot the engines to Arizona for the grapefruit special, with the rolling stock from the Scranton coal run I mentioned. Send the orders out at once.
You'll do nothing of the kind, she gasped, too incredulous to be angry.
Eddie did not answer. Miggs glanced at her with what would have been astonishment if his eyes were capable of registering a reaction.
"Send the orders," he said to Eddie, with no emphasis, and walked out. Eddie was jotting notations on a piece of paper.
"Are you crazy?"
she asked. He raised his eyes to her as though exhausted by hours of beating.
"We'll have to, Dagny," he said, his voice dead.
"What is that?" she asked, pointing at the outer door that had closed on Mr. Meggs.
"The Director of Unification."
"What?"
"The Washington representative in charge of the Railroad Unification Plan."
"What's that?"
"It's... oh, wait, Dagny, are you all right? Were you hurt? Was it a plane crash?"
She had never imagined what the face of Eddie Willers would look like in the process of aging, but she was seeing it now. Aging at 35 and within the span of 1 month. It was not a matter of texture or wrinkles. It was the same face with the same muscles, but saturated by the withering look of resignation to a pain accepted as hopeless. She smiled, gently and confidently, in understanding, in dismissal of all problems, and said, extending her hand,
"All right, Eddie. Hello."
He took her hand and pressed it to his lips, a thing he had never done before, his manner neither daring nor apologetic, but simply and openly personal.
"It was a plane crash," she said. "And Eddie, so that you won't worry, I'll tell you the truth. I wasn't hurt, not seriously. But that's not the story I'm going to give to the press and to all the others. So you're never to mention it."
"Of course. I had no way to communicate with anyone, but not because I was hurt. It's all I can tell you, Eddie. Don't ask me where I was or why it took me so long to return."
"I won't."
"Now tell me, what is the Railroad Unification Plan?"
"It's... oh, do you mind? Let Jim tell you.
He will soon enough. I just don't have the stomach. Unless you want me to," he added, with a conscientious effort at discipline.
"No, you don't have to. Just tell me whether I understood that unificator correctly.
He wants you to cancel the Comet for 2 days in order to give her engines to a grapefruit special in Arizona?"
"That's right."
"And he's canceled a coal train in order to get cars to lug grapefruit?"
"Yes."
"Grapefruit?"
"That's right."
"Why?"
"Dagny, why is a word nobody uses any longer."
After a moment, she asked, "Have you any guess about the reason?"
"Guess? I don't have to guess. I know."
"All right, what is it?"
"The grapefruit special is for the Smather brothers. The Smather brothers bought a fruit ranch in Arizona a year ago from a man who went bankrupt under the Equalization of Opportunity Bill. He had owned the ranch for 30 years. The Smather brothers were in the punchboard business the year before. They bought the ranch by means of a loan from Washington under a project for the reclamation of distressed areas, such as Arizona. The Smather brothers have friends in Washington."
"Well?"
"Dagny, everybody knows it. Everybody knows how train schedules have been run in the past 3 weeks, and why some districts and some shippers get transportation while others don't. What we're not supposed to do is say that we know it. We're supposed to pretend to believe that public welfare is the only reason for any decision, and that the public welfare of the city of New York requires the immediate delivery of a large quantity of grapefruit." He paused, then added, "The Director of Unification is sole judge of the public welfare, and has sole authority over the allocation of any motive power and rolling stock on any railroad anywhere in the United States." There was a moment of silence.
"I see," she said. In another moment, she asked, "What has been done about the Winston Tunnel?"
"Oh, that was abandoned 3 weeks ago. They never unearthed the trains. The equipment gave out."
"What has been done about rebuilding the old line around the tunnel?"
"That was shelved."
"Then are we running any transcontinental traffic?" He gave her an odd glance. Oh, yes, he said bitterly. Through the detour of the Kansas Western? No. Eddie, what has been happening here in the past month? He smiled as if his words were an ugly confession. We've been making money in the past month, he answered. She saw the outer door open and James Taggart come in, accompanied by Mr. Meggs. Eddie, do you want to be present at the conference? She asked. Or would you rather miss this one? No. I want to be present. Jim's face looked like a crumpled piece of paper, though its soft, puffed flesh had acquired no additional lines. Dagny, there's a lot of things to discuss, a lot of important changes which, he said shrilly, his voice rushing in ahead of his person. Oh, I'm glad to see you back. I'm happy that you're alive, he added impatiently, remembering. Now there are some urgent... Let's go to my office, she said. Her office was like a historical reconstruction, restored and maintained by Eddie Willers. Her map, her calendar, the picture of Nat Taggart were on the walls, and no trace was left of the Clifton-Losey era. I understand that I am still the operating vice president of this railroad, she asked, sitting down at her desk. You are, said Taggart hastily, accusingly, almost defiantly. You certainly are, and don't you forget it. You haven't quit. You're still... Have you? No, I haven't quit. Now, the most urgent thing to do is to tell that to the press. Tell them that you're back on the job and where you were and... And by the way, where were you? Eddie, she said, will you make a note on this and send it to the press? My plane developed engine trouble while I was flying over the Rocky Mountains to the Taggart Tunnel. I lost my way, looking for an emergency landing, and crashed in an uninhabited mountain section of Wyoming. I was found by an old sheepherder and his wife, who took me to their cabin, deep in the wilderness, 50 miles away from the nearest settlement. I was badly injured and remained unconscious for most of 2 weeks. The old couple had no telephone, no radio, no means of communication or transportation, except an old truck that broke down when they attempted to use it. I had to remain with them until I recovered sufficient strength to walk. I walked the 50 miles to the foothills, then hitchhiked my way to a Taggart station in Nebraska. I see, said Taggart. Well, that's fine. Now, when you give the press interview... I'm not going to give any press interviews. What? But they've been calling me all day. They're waiting. It's essential. He had an air of panic. It's most crucially essential. Who's been calling you all day? People in Washington and others. They're waiting for your statement. She pointed at Eddie's notes. There's my statement. But that's not enough. You must say that you haven't quit. That's obvious, isn't it? I'm back. You must say something about it. Such as what? Something personal. To whom? To the country. People were worried about you. You must reassure them. The story will reassure them if anyone was worried about me. That's not what I mean. Well, what do you mean? I mean... He stopped, his eyes avoiding hers. I mean... He sat, searching for words, cracking his knuckles. Jim was going to pieces, she thought. The jerky impatience, the shrillness, the aura of panic were new. Crude outbreaks of a tone of ineffectual menace had replaced his pose of cautious smoothness. I mean... He was searching for words to name his meaning without naming it, she thought, to make her understand that which he did not want to be understood. I mean... The public. I know what you mean, she said. No, Jim, I'm not going to reassure the public about the state of our industry. Now you're... The public had better be as unreassured as it has the wits to be. Now proceed to business. I proceed to business, Jim. He glanced at Mr. Meggs. Mr. Meggs sat silently, his legs crossed, smoking a cigarette. He wore a jacket which was not, but looked like, a military uniform. The flesh of his neck bulged over the collar, and the flesh of his body strained against the narrow waistline intended to disguise it. He wore a ring with a large yellow diamond that flashed when he moved his stubby fingers. "You've met Mr. Meggs," said Taggart. "I'm so glad that the two of you will get along well together." He made an expectant half-pause, but received no answer from either. "Mr. Meggs is the representative of the Railroad Unification Plan. You'll have many opportunities to cooperate with him."
"What is the Railroad Unification Plan?"
"It is a new national setup that went into effect 3 weeks ago, which you will appreciate and approve of and find extremely practical." She marveled at the futility of his method. He was acting as if, by naming her opinion in advance, he would make her unable to alter it. "It is an emergency setup which has saved the country's transportation system."
"What is the plan?"
"You realize, of course, the insurmountable difficulties of any sort of construction job during this period of emergency. It is temporarily impossible to lay new track. Therefore, the country's top problem is to preserve the transportation industry as a whole, to preserve its existing plant and all of its existing facilities. The national survival requires..."
"What is the plan?"
"As a policy of national survival, the railroads of the country have been unified into a single team, pooling their resources. All of their gross revenue is turned over to the Railroad Pool Board in Washington, which acts as trustee for the industry as a whole, and divides the total income among the various railroads according to a more modern principle of distribution."
"What principle?"
"Now don't worry. Property rights have been fully preserved and protected. They've merely been given a new form. Every railroad retains independent responsibility for its own operations, its train schedules, and the maintenance of its track and equipment. As its contribution to the national pool, every railroad permits any other, when conditions so require, to use its track and facilities without charge. At the end of the year, the pool board distributes the total gross income, and every individual railroad is paid, not on the haphazard, old-fashioned basis of the number of trains run or the tonnage of freight carried, but on the basis of its need. That is, the preservation of its track being its main need. Every individual railroad is paid according to the mileage of the track which it owns and maintains." She heard the words. She understood the meaning. She was unable to make it real. To grant the respect of anger, concern, opposition to a nightmare piece of insanity that rested on nothing but people's willingness to pretend to believe that it was sane. She felt a numbed emptiness, and the sense of being thrown far below the realm where moral indignation is pertinent.
"Whose track are we using for our transcontinental traffic?"
she asked, her voice flat and dry.
"Why, our own, of course," said Taggart hastily.
"That is, from New York to Bedford, Illinois. We run our trains out of Bedford on the track of the Atlantic Southern."
"To San Francisco?"
"Well, it's much faster than that long detour you tried to establish."
"We run our trains without charge for the use of the track?"
"Besides, your detour couldn't have lasted. The Kansas Western Rail was shot, and besides..."
"Without charge for the use of the Atlantic Southern track?"
"Well, we're not charging them for the use of our Mississippi Bridge, either." After a moment, she asked,
"Have you looked at a map?"
"Sure," said Meggs unexpectedly. "You own the largest track mileage of any railroad in the country, so you've got nothing to worry about."
Eddie Willers burst out laughing.
Meggs glanced at him blankly. "What's the matter with you?" he asked.
"Nothing," said Eddie wearily. "Nothing."
"Mr. Meggs," she said, "if you look at a map,
you will see that 2/3 of the cost of maintaining a track for our transcontinental traffic is given to us free and is paid by our competitor. Why, sure, he said, but his eyes narrowed, watching her suspiciously, as if he were wondering what motive prompted her to so explicit a statement. While we're paid for owning miles of useless track, which carries no traffic, she said. Meggs understood, and leaned back as if he had lost all further interest in the discussion. That's not true, snapped Taggart. We're running a great number of local trains to serve the region of our former transcontinental line, through Iowa, Nebraska, and Colorado, and on the other side of the tunnel, through California, Nevada, and Utah. We're running 2 locals a day, said Eddie Willers, in the dry, blankly innocent tone of a business report. Fewer some places. What determines the number of trains which any given railroad is obligated to run? She asked. The public welfare, said Taggart. The pool board, said Eddie. How many trains have been discontinued in the country in the past 3 weeks? As a matter of fact, said Taggart eagerly, the plan has helped to harmonize the industry and to eliminate cutthroat competition. It has eliminated 30% of the trains run in the country, said Eddie. The only competition left is in the applications to the board for permission to cancel trains. The railroad to survive will be the one that manages to run no trains at all. Has anybody calculated how long the Atlantic Southern is expected to be able to remain in business? That's no skin off your, started Meggs. Please, Cuffy, cried Taggart. The president of the Atlantic Southern, said Eddie impassively, has committed suicide. That had nothing to do with this, yelled Taggart. It was over a personal matter. She remained silent. She sat, looking at their faces. There was still an element of wonder in the numbed indifference of her mind. Jim had always managed to switch the weight of his failures upon the strongest plants around him, and to survive by destroying them to pay for his errors, as he had done with Dan Conway, as he had done with the industries of Colorado. But this did not have even the rationality of a looter. This pouncing upon the drained carcass of a weaker, a half-bankrupt competitor for a moment's delay, with nothing but a cracking bone between the pouncer and the abyss. The impulse of the habit of reason almost pushed her to speak, to argue, to demonstrate the self-evident. But she looked at their faces, and she saw that they knew it. In some terms different from hers, in some inconceivable manner of consciousness, they knew all that she could tell them. It was useless to prove to them the irrational horror of their course and of its consequences. Both Meggs and Taggart knew it, and the secret of their consciousness was the means by which they escaped the finality of their knowledge. I see, she said quietly. Well, what would you rather have had me do? Screamed Taggart. Give up our transcontinental traffic? Go bankrupt? Turn the railroad into a miserable East Coast local? Her 2 words seemed to have hit him worse than any indignant objection. He seemed to be shaking with terror at that which the quiet I see had acknowledged seeing. I couldn't help it. We had to have a transcontinental track. There was no way to get around the tunnel. We had no money to pay for any extra costs. Something had to be done. We had to have a track. Meggs was looking at him with a glance of part astonishment, part disgust. I am not arguing, Jim, she said dryly. We couldn't permit a railroad like Taggart Transcontinental to crash. It would have been a national catastrophe. We had to think of all the cities and industries and shippers and passengers and employees and stockholders whose lives depend on us. It wasn't just for ourselves. It was for the public welfare. Everybody agrees that the railroad unification plan is practical. The best informed... Jim, she said. If you have any further business to discuss with me, discuss it. You've never considered the social angle of anything, he said, in a sullen, retreating voice. She noticed that this form of pretense was as unreal to Mr. Meggs as it was to her, though for an antipodal reason.
He was looking at Jim with bored contempt. Jim appeared to her suddenly as a man who had tried to find a middle course between two poles, Meg's and herself, and who was now seeing that his course was narrowing and that he was to be ground between two straight walls. "Mr. Meggs," she asked, prompted by a touch of bitterly amused curiosity, "what is your economic plan for day after tomorrow?" She saw his bleary brown eyes focus upon her without expression.
"You're impractical," he said.
"It's perfectly useless to theorize about the future," snapped Taggart, "when we have to take care of the emergency of the moment. In the long run,
we'll all be dead," said Meggs.
Then abruptly he shot to his feet.
"I'll run along, Jim," he said. "I've got no time to waste on conversations." He added, "You talk to her about that matter of doing something to stop all those train wrecks, if she's the little girl who's such a wizard at railroading."
It was said inoffensively. He was a man who would not know when he was giving offense or taking it. "I'll see you later, Cuffy," said Taggart, as Meggs walked out with no parting glance at any of them. Taggart looked at her, expectantly and fearfully, as if dreading her comment, yet desperately hoping to hear some word, any word. "Well?" she asked.
"What do you mean?"
"Have you anything else to discuss?"
"Well, I..."
He sounded disappointed.
"Yes," he cried, in the tone of a desperate plunge. "I have another matter to discuss, the most important one of all, that..."
"Your growing number of train wrecks?"
"No, not that."
"What, then?"
"It's that you're going to appear on Bertram Scudder's radio program tonight."
She leaned back.
"Am I?"
"Dagny, it's imperative. It's crucial. There's nothing to be done about it. To refuse is out of the question. In times like these, one has no choice, and..."
She glanced at her watch. "I'll give you 3 minutes to explain, if you want to be heard at all. And you'd better speak straight."
"All right," he said desperately. "It's considered most important, on the highest levels. I mean, Chick Morrison and Wesley Mouch and Mr. Thompson, as high as that. That you should make a speech to the nation, a morale-building speech, you know, saying that you haven't quit."
"Why?"
"Because everybody thought you had. You don't know what's been going on lately, but it's sort of uncanny. The country is full of rumors, all sorts of rumors about everything, all of them dangerous. Disruptive, I mean. People seem to do nothing but whisper. They don't believe the newspapers, they don't believe the best speakers, they believe every vicious, scaremongering piece of gossip that comes floating around. There's no confidence left, no faith, no order, no respect for authority. People seem to be on the verge of panic."
"Well?"
"Well, for one thing, it's that damnable business of all those big industrialists who vanished into thin air. Nobody's been able to explain it, and it's giving them the jitters. There's all sorts of hysterical stuff being whispered about it, but what they whisper mostly is that no decent man will work for those people. They mean the people in Washington. Now do you see? You wouldn't suspect that you were so famous, but you are, or you've become ever since your plane crash. Nobody believed the plane crash. They all thought you had broken the law. That is Directive 10-289, and deserted. There's a lot of popular misunderstanding of Directive 10-289, a lot of, well, unrest. Now you see how important it is that you go on the air and tell people that it isn't true that Directive 10-289 is destroying industry, that it's a sound piece of legislation devised for everybody's good, and that if they'll just be patient a little longer, things will improve and prosperity will return. They don't believe any public official anymore. You're an industrialist. One of the few left of the old school, and the only one who's ever come back after they thought you'd gone. You're known as a reactionary who's opposed to Washington policies.
so the people will believe you. It would have a great influence on them. It would buttress their confidence. It would help their morale. Now do you see? He had rushed on, encouraged by the odd look of her face, a look of contemplation that was almost a faint half-smile. She had listened, hearing through his words the sound of Reardon's voice saying to her on a spring evening over a year ago, "They need some sort of sanction from us. I don't know the nature of that sanction. But, Dagny, I know that if we value our lives, we must not give it to them. If they put you on a torture rack, don't give it to them. Let them destroy your railroad and my mills, but don't give it to them. Now do you see?" "Oh, yes, Jim. I see." He could not interpret the sound of her voice. It was low. It was part moan, part chuckle, part triumph. But it was the first sound of emotion to come from her, and he plunged on, with no choice but to hope. "I promised them in Washington that you'd speak. We can't fail them. Not in an issue of this kind. We can't afford to be suspected of disloyalty. It's all arranged. You'll be the guest speaker on Bertram Scudder's program tonight at 10:30. He's got a radio program where he interviews prominent public figures. It's a national hookup. He has a large following. He reaches over 20 million people. The office of the morale conditioner has..." "The what?" "The morale conditioner. That's Chick Morrison. Has called me 3 times to make sure that nothing would go wrong. They've issued orders to all the news broadcasters who've been announcing it all day, all over the country, telling people to listen to you tonight on Bertram Scudder's Hour." He looked at her as if he were demanding both an answer and the recognition that her answer was the element of least importance in these circumstances. She said, "You know what I think of the Washington policies and of Directive 10-289. At a time like this, we can't afford the luxury of thinking." She laughed aloud. "But don't you see that you can't refuse them now?" he yelled. "If you don't appear after all those announcements, it will support the rumors. It will amount to an open declaration of disloyalty." "The trap won't work, Jim."
"What trap?"
"The one you're always setting up."
"I don't know what you mean."
"Yes, you do. You knew, all of you knew it, that I would refuse. So you pushed me into a public trap, where my refusal would become an embarrassing scandal for you, more embarrassing than you thought I'd dare to cause. You were counting on me to save your faces and the necks you stuck out. I won't save them."
"But I promised it."
"I didn't.
But we can't refuse them.
Don't you see that they've got us hogtied? That they're holding us by the throat. Don't you know what they can do to us through this railroad pool, or through the unification board, or through the moratorium on our bonds?" "I knew that 2 years ago."
He was shaking. There was some formless, desperate, almost superstitious quality in his terror, out of proportion to the dangers he named. She felt suddenly certain that it came from something deeper than his fear of bureaucratic reprisal, that the reprisal was the only identification of it which he would permit himself to know, a reassuring identification which had a semblance of rationality and hid his true motive. She felt certain that it was not the country's panic he wanted to stave off, but his own, that he and Chick Morrison and Wesley Mouch and all the rest of the looting crew needed her sanction, not to reassure their victims, but to reassure themselves, though the allegedly crafty, the allegedly practical idea of deluding their victims was the only identification they gave to their own motive and their hysterical insistence. With an awed contempt, awed by the enormity of the sight, she wondered what inner degradation those men had to reach in order to arrive at a level of self-deception where they would seek the extorted approval of an unwilling victim as the moral sanction they needed, they who thought that they were merely deceiving the world.
"We have no choice," he cried. "Nobody has any choice."
"Get out of here," she said, her voice very quiet and low.
Some tonal quality in the sound of her voice struck the note of the unconfessed within him, as if, never allowing it into words, he knew from what knowledge that sound had come. He got out. She glanced at Eddie. He looked like a man worn by fighting one more of the attacks of disgust which he was learning to endure as a chronic condition. After a moment, he asked, "Dagny, what became of Quentin Daniels? You were flying after him, weren't you?" "Yes," she said. "He's gone." "To the destroyer?" The word hit her like a physical blow. It was the first touch of the outer world upon that radiant presence which she had kept within her all day, as a silent, changeless vision, a private vision, not to be affected by any of the things around her, not to be thought about, only to be felt as the source of her strength. The destroyer, she realized, was the name of that vision, here, in their world. "Yes," she said dully, with effort, "to the destroyer." Then she closed her hands over the edge of the desk to steady her purpose and her posture, and said, with a bitter hint of a smile, "Well, Eddie, let's see what two impractical persons like you and me can do about preventing the train wrecks." It was 2 hours later, when she was alone at her desk, bent over sheets of paper that bore nothing but figures, yet were like a motion picture film unrolling to tell her the whole story of the railroad in the past 4 weeks, that the buzzer rang and her secretary's voice said, "Mrs. Reardon to see you, Miss Taggart." "Mr. Reardon?" she asked, incredulously, unable to believe either. "No, Mrs. Reardon." She let a moment pass, then said, "Please ask her to come in." There was some peculiar touch of emphasis in Lillian Reardon's bearing when she entered and walked toward the desk. She wore a tailored suit, with a loose, bright bow hanging casually sidewise for a note of elegant incongruity, and a small hat tilted at an angle considered smart by virtue of being considered amusing. Her face was a shade too smooth, her steps a shade too slow, and she walked almost as if she were swinging her hips. "How do you do, Miss Taggart?" she said in a lazily gracious voice, a drawing-room voice which seemed to strike in that office the same style of incongruity as her suit and her bow. Dagny inclined her head gravely. Lillian glanced about the office. Her glance had the same style of amusement as her hat, an amusement purporting to express maturity by the conviction that life could be nothing but ridiculous. "Please sit down," said Dagny. Lillian sat down, relaxing into a confident, gracefully casual posture. When she turned her face to Dagny, the amusement was still there, but its shading was now different. It seemed to suggest that they shared a secret, which would make her presence here seem preposterous to the world, but self-evidently logical to the two of them. She stressed it by remaining silent. "What can I do for you?" "I came to tell you," said Lillian pleasantly, "that you will appear on Bertram Scudder's broadcast tonight." She detected no astonishment in Dagny's face, no shock, only the glance of an engineer studying a motor that makes an irregular sound. "I assume," said Dagny, "that you are fully aware of the form of your sentence." "Oh, yes," said Lillian. "Then proceed to support it."
"I beg your pardon?"
"Proceed to tell me." Lillian gave a brief little laugh, its forced brevity betraying that this was not quite the attitude she had expected. "I am sure that no lengthy explanations will be necessary," she said. "You know why your appearance on that broadcast is important to those in power. I know why you have refused to appear. I know your convictions on the subject. You may have attached no importance to it, but you do know that my sympathy has always been on the side of the system now in power. Therefore, you will understand my interest in the issue and my place in it. When your brother told me that you had refused, I decided to take a hand in the matter, because, you see, I am one of the very few who know that you are not in a position to refuse."
I am not one of those few as yet, said Dagny. Lillian smiled. Well, yes, I must explain a little further. You realize that your radio appearance will have the same value for those in power as the action of my husband when he signed the gift certificate that turned Reardon Medal over to them. You know how frequently and how usefully they have been mentioning it in all of their propaganda. I didn't know that, said Dagny sharply. Oh, of course. You have been away for most of the last 2 months, so you might have missed the constant reminders, in the press, on the radio, in public speeches, that even Hank Reardon approves of and supports Directive 10-289, since he has voluntarily signed his medal over to the nation. Even Hank Reardon. That discourages a great many recalcitrants and helps to keep them in line. She leaned back and asked, in the tone of a casual aside, "Have you ever asked him why he signed?" Dagny did not answer. She did not seem to hear that it was a question. She sat still, and her face was expressionless, but her eyes seemed too large, and they were fixed on Lillian's, as if she were now intent upon nothing but hearing Lillian to the end. "No, I didn't think you knew it. I didn't think that he would ever tell you," said Lillian, her voice smoother, as if recognizing the signposts and sliding comfortably down the anticipated course. "Yet you must learn the reason that made him sign, because it is the same reason that will make you appear on Bertram Scudder's broadcast tonight." She paused, wishing to be urged. Dagny waited. "It is a reason," said Lillian, "which should please you, as far as my husband's action is concerned. Consider what that signature meant to him. Reardon Medal was his greatest achievement, the summation of the best in his life, the final symbol of his pride. And my husband, as you have reason to know, is an extremely passionate man, his pride in himself being perhaps his greatest passion. Reardon Medal was more than an achievement to him. It was the symbol of his ability to achieve, of his independence, of his struggle, of his rise. It was his property, his by right. And you know what rights mean to a man as strict as he, and what property means to a man as possessive. He would have gladly died to defend it, rather than surrender it to the men he despised. This is what it meant to him, and this is what he gave up. You will be glad to know that he gave it up for your sake, Miss Taggart, for the sake of your reputation and your honor. He signed the gift certificate surrendering Reardon Medal under the threat that the adultery he was carrying on with you would be exposed to the eyes of the world. Oh, yes, we had full proof of it, in every intimate detail. I believe that you hold a philosophy which disapproves of sacrifice, but in this case you are most certainly a woman, so I'm sure that you will feel gratification at the magnitude of the sacrifice a man has made for the privilege of using your body. You have undoubtedly taken great pleasure in the nights which he spent in your bed. You may now take pleasure in the knowledge of what those nights have cost him. And since you like bluntness, don't you, Miss Taggart? Since your chosen status is that of a whore, I take my hat off to you in regard to the price you exacted, which none of your sisters could ever have hoped to match. Lillian's voice had kept growing reluctantly sharper, like a drill head that kept breaking by being unable to find the line of the fault in the stone. Dagny was still looking at her, but the intensity had vanished from Dagny's eyes and posture. Lillian wondered why she felt as if Dagny's face were hit by a spotlight. She could detect no particular expression. It was simply a face in natural repose, and the clarity seemed to come from its structure, from the precision of its sharp planes, the firmness of the mouth, the steadiness of the eyes. She could not decipher the expression of the eyes. It seemed incongruous. It resembled the calm, not of a woman, but of a scholar.
It had that peculiar luminous quality which is the fearlessness of satisfied knowledge.
"It was I," said Lillian softly, "who informed the bureaucrats about my husband's adultery."
Dagny noticed the first flicker of feeling in Lillian's lifeless eyes. It resembled pleasure, but so distantly that it looked like sunlight reflected from the dead surface of the moon to the stagnant water of a swamp. It flickered for an instant and went.
"It was I," said Lillian, "who took Reardon Medal away from him."
It sounded almost like a plea. It was not within the power of Dagny's consciousness ever to understand that plea, or to know what response Lillian had hoped to find. She knew only that she had not found it when she heard the sudden shrillness of Lillian's voice. "Have you understood me?"
"Yes."
"Then you know what I demand and why you'll obey me. You thought you were invincible, you and he, didn't you?" The voice was attempting smoothness, but it was jerking unevenly. "You have always acted on no will but your own. A luxury I have not been able to afford. For once, and in compensation, I will see you acting on mine. You can't fight me. You can't buy your way out of it with those dollars which you're able to make and I'm not. There's no profit you can offer me. I'm devoid of greed. I'm not paid by the bureaucrats for doing this. I am doing it without gain."
"Without gain. Do you understand me?"
"Yes."
"Then no further explanations are necessary.
Only the reminder that all the factual evidence, hotel registers, jewelry bills, and stuff like that, is still in the possession of the right persons and will be broadcast on every radio program tomorrow, unless you appear on one radio program tonight.
Is this clear?"
"Yes."
"Now what is your answer?"
She saw the luminous scholar eyes looking at her, and suddenly she felt as if too much of her were seen, and as if she were not seen at all.
"I am glad that you have told me," said Dagny. "I will appear on Bertram Scudder's broadcast tonight."
There was a beam of white light beading down upon the glittering metal of a microphone, in the center of a glass cage imprisoning her with Bertram Scudder. The sparks of glitter were greenish-blue. The microphone was made of Reardon metal. Above them, beyond a sheet of glass, she could distinguish a booth with two rows of faces looking down at her. The lax, anxious face of James Taggart, with Lillian Reardon beside him, her hand resting reassuringly on his arm. A man who had arrived by plane from Washington and had been introduced to her as Chick Morrison, and a group of young men from his staff, who talked about percentage curves of intellectual influence and acted like motorcycle cops. Bertram Scudder seemed to be afraid of her. He clung to the microphone, spitting words into its delicate mesh, into the ears of the country, introducing the subject of his program. He was laboring to sound cynical, skeptical, superior, and hysterical together, to sound like a man who sneers at the vanity of all human beliefs and thereby demands an instantaneous belief from his listeners. A small patch of moisture glistened on the back of his neck. He was describing in over-colored detail her month of convalescence in the lonely cabin of a sheepherder, then her heroic trudging down 50 miles of mountain trails for the sake of resuming her duties to the people in this grave hour of national emergency. "And if any of you have been deceived by vicious rumors aimed to undermine your faith in the great social program of our leaders, you may trust the word of Miss Taggart, who—" She stood, looking up at the white beam. Specks of dust were whirling in the beam, and she noticed that one of them was alive. It was a gnat, with a tiny sparkle in place of its beating wings. It was struggling for some frantic purpose of its own, and she watched it, feeling as distant from its purpose as from that of the world.
Miss Taggart is an impartial observer, a brilliant businesswoman who has often been critical of the government in the past and who may be said to represent the extreme conservative viewpoint held by such giants of industry as Hank Reardon. Yet even she wondered at how easy it felt when one did not have to feel. She seemed to be standing naked on public display, and a beam of light was enough to support her, because there was no weight of pain in her, no hope, no regret, no concern, no future. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I will present to you the heroine of this night, our most uncommon guest. Pain came back to her in a sudden, piercing stab, like a long splinter from the glass of a protective wall shattered by the knowledge that the next words would be hers. It came back for the brief length of a name in her mind, the name of the man she had called the Destroyer. She did not want him to hear what she would now have to say. If you hear it. The pain was like a voice crying it to him. You won't believe the things I have said to you. No, worse, the things which I have not said, but which you knew and believed and accepted. You will think that I was not free to offer them, and that my days with you were a lie. This will destroy my 1 month and 10 of your years. This was not the way I wanted you to learn it, not like this, not tonight. But you will. You who've watched and known my every movement, you who are watching me now, wherever you are, you will hear it. But it has to be said. The last descendant of an illustrious name in our industrial history, the woman executive possible only in America, the operating vice president of a great railroad, Miss Dagny Taggart. Then she felt the touch of Reardon metal as her hand closed over the stem of the microphone, and it was suddenly easy, not with the drugged ease of indifference, but with the bright, clear, living ease of action. I came here to tell you about the social program, the political system, and the moral philosophy under which you are now living. There was so calm, so natural, so total a certainty in the sound of her voice that the mere sound seemed to carry an immense persuasiveness. You have heard it said that I believe that this system has depravity as its motive, plunder as its goal, lies, fraud, and force as its method, and destruction as its only result. You have also heard it said that, like Hank Reardon, I am a loyal supporter of this system and that I give my voluntary cooperation to present policies, such as Directive 10-289. I have come here to tell you the truth about it. It is true that I share the stand of Hank Reardon. His political convictions are mine. You have heard him denounced in the past as a reactionary who opposed every step, measure, slogan, and premise of the present system. Now you hear him praised as our greatest industrialist, whose judgment on the value of economic policies may safely be trusted. It is true. You may trust his judgment. If you are now beginning to fear that you are in the power of an irresponsible evil, that the country is collapsing, and that you will soon be left to starve, consider the views of our ablest industrialist, who knows what conditions are necessary to make production possible and to permit a country to survive. Consider all that you know about his views. At such times as he was able to speak, you have heard him tell you that this government's policies were leading you to enslavement and destruction. Yet he did not denounce the final climax of these policies. Directive 10-289. You have heard him fighting for his rights, his and yours, for his independence, for his property. Yet he did not fight Directive 10-289. He signed voluntarily, so you have been told, the gift certificate that surrendered Reardon Metal to his enemies. He signed the one paper which, by all of his previous record, you had expected him to fight to the death. What could this mean,
you have constantly been told, unless it meant that even he recognized the necessity of Directive 10-289 and sacrificed his personal interests for the sake of the country. Judge his views by the motive of that action, you have constantly been told, and with this I agree unreservedly. Judge his views by the motive of that action. And, for whatever value you attach to my opinion and to any warning I may give you, judge my views also by the motive of that action, because his convictions are mine. For 2 years I had been Hank Reardon's mistress. Let there be no misunderstanding about it. I am saying this not as a shameful confession, but with the highest sense of pride. I had been his